We've been talking, yes, last week we talked about dependent origination and causality, and took a look at a specific example of how this idea of dependent origination can be looked at and addressed in our life. And we talked about specifically some ideas about our sense of inadequacy and kind of narrowed in on how that could be addressed. And so I want to continue tonight to talk about causality and dependent origination. And just to explore that a little further and specifically, this idea came up. Somebody asked a question recently that I thought would be useful to explore. And they said, they're talking about the suffering that is attendant on a good action. So we do some good thing, or we do something out of, for selfless reasons, and suffering arises as a result, may arise as a result of that. And at the time, we talked about it from one angle, the angle of just accepting that that may actually be the case, that we can act from an altruistic place, a place of selflessness, and difficulty may arise because of that. You know, we may have to tell the truth in a circumstance where the people around us, you know, would really rather not. We might get censored for that, something like that. But there's also another way, another possibility there, which is the possibility that we could think that we're acting from an altruistic place, and that by sort of social standards, we are doing a selfless act, but we're actually doing it with a selfish motive. And oftentimes that can be unbeknownst to us. In the reading, there was a section, and this was brought up in this particular case. He's talking about the force of past actions. So to set the context, in terms of causality and dependent origination, the idea is that we, wherever we are, whatever situation that we're in, it's the result of a complex set of causes. Everything arises from a cause. Every thought, feeling, even physical things arise because of a cause. And because we're complex kind of systems of organs and thoughts and ideas, there are many causes that go into our particular present conditions. And it's useful to know that everything arises from a cause, and this is the basic idea of dependent origination. Everything arises from a cause. That's a useful piece of information because we can, knowing that, we can affect our future. We can affect our future results. Now, in one sense, there's this kind of forward, our life is like a river. And so there's this forward momentum of causality going on in our lives. And there isn't it's not possible for us to stop it. It's not possible for us to bring that to a halt in any kind of practical or simple way. It is possible, however, if we do that, if we try to stop our life, it will just go in a different direction. It will just be diverted. I mean, we can even commit suicide, as we've been talking about with regard to Sadaki. But from the point of view of dependent origination and what the Buddha taught, suicide really doesn't do anything for us. It just creates another negative consequence for some being in the future. We kill ourselves, and then we are reborn with the difficult karma of having killed ourselves. Mm-hmm. Killing, of course, is a non-perceptual action, and when we take our own life, then we're breaking the precepts, basically, in most cases. So then we're reborn with a consequence of negativity. So there really isn't a way we can stop our life, We can't abruptly change it in any way, but we can redirect it. We can focus its path in a different direction. We can gradually move it into a different direction. And that's a critical thing, because that means we can alleviate our suffering. We can transcend suffering. And again, that's the kind of practical application of dependent origination, that idea. I can do something about the direction of my life. So there's this force. Our life is like a river. There's a kind of force going on. We're moving forward. And that force is a set of complex causes. And in terms of dependent origination, each one of us has a particular question or a kind of area of spiritual issue that we need to look at in our lives, or that it sort of characterizes our life. And that is what we would call a koan, our natural koan, our natural spiritual problem that arises and pretty much accompanies us throughout our life. And in terms of our Zen practice, what we're trying to do is, in a sense, solve that koan. We're trying to awaken to the truth. We're trying to awaken to the Buddha mind. And that awakening process is the solution of our koan. In one sense, our koan is solved, but in another sense, it doesn't ever go away. We simply understand how to deal with it, how to understand how to deal with the quality of our life, the conditions of our life. And that koan, that spiritual problem, is again part of this forward momentum. The idea in dependent origination is that until we have really penetrated and understood what our koan is, our spiritual problem, as it kind of manifests right in front of us, we will continue to be, in a way, headed in a direction of suffering. Now, that's a pretty important idea. We will be continuing to head in the direction of suffering. We will continue to be, in a way, bound to the cycle of birth and death. And it is through a practice that we sever that. We penetrate the koan, we solve the problem, we sever our binding to birth and death. Even if we are, so, and until we solve that problem, there's going to be some clinging to birth and death. As we go along in our training and do the practice, we have the experience of having, in one sense, a reduction of suffering or an increase of peace in our life, peaceful heart. And in that sense, we're changing the course of the river of our life. And eventually, the changing of that course will result in effectively resolving that problem, that koan. And as we gradually change the course, we're in a way, all of us have a mixture of delusion and enlightenment, a mixture of deluded kind of aspects of our life and a mixture of enlightened aspects of our lives, where we're doing some questionable things and some pretty good things. And for most of the people in this room, I think we're not leading the life of crime or whatever. So the balance is on the enlightened side. Even though that is true, oftentimes when we do good acts, because of the forward momentum of that koan, that unresolved spiritual problem, there is still a there is still the consequence, even though we're kind of living in a way that is mostly okay, there's still the consequence of being bound to birth and death, being bound to the cycle of suffering and rebirth. And it is through practice that we become unbound from that. We become liberated, we become free. And that's the idea that I'm getting at here, that we can do good things, we can do positive things, but still be in a way motivated by the distortion of our inward problem. And the degree to which we are motivated by the distortion of our inward problem is the degree to which we will suffer and be unliberated. We can actually be reborn into a heaven realm, a realm where there is virtually no suffering, but still be bound to birth and death. And the significance of that is that whatever positive situation that we find ourselves in, you know, nice as it is, it is impermanent. It will pass away. The heaven realm, wherever we're reborn, and by reborn, I use that term loosely, it might be in a future lifetime we are reborn into heaven, but we might find ourselves in a heaven realm in this particular lifetime. You know, everything's going right, we got the right partner, we got the right job, we got the right car, we got the right cell phone, whatever it is. And there's nothing wrong with these things, except that as a Buddhist, we need to understand that they're impermanent, that they will pass away. And I don't mean to sit to like harsh your buzz or anything like that by telling you that they're impermanent. I'm just saying that's the reality of the thing. Our practice, again, is constantly being grounded in the reality of life, this life just as it is. When we see this life just as it is, there's a luminous quality to it, that even when it's kind of lousy, there's that luminous quality when we penetrate to it. Just as it is, so we're just constantly bringing ourselves back to life just as it is. Understanding that, again, this idea of a heaven realm, we just have to, by being grounded in the recognition that it's impermanent, we're free from it. We can enjoy it while it's there, but when it passes away, we won't be moved by that. Now, again, to bring up the idea of the unresolved spiritual problem that we have, the degree to which the degree to which that spiritual problem is unresolved will be the degree to which we cling to external circumstances. And our clinging to external circumstances is what eventually causes us suffering. So the focus of our work then is to constantly be sitting still, meditating throughout our daily lives, letting go of what is arising and recognizing the impermanence of things, recognizing the impermanence of the bad things and recognizing the impermanence of the good things. And in that sense, we have a little, I kind of have a little bit of an ironical approach to my own mind or my own circumstances, or a little bit of suspicion about my own circumstances. Like, oh, this is really great, but how am I fooling myself about this? You know, what's really going on here? Come on, what's going on? And I'm not, again, trying to be negative, but be real. What's really happening? How am I getting invested in this external circumstance? And part of the thing about that we're trying to do in our spiritual lives is to come to terms with our own capacity to fool ourselves, to tell ourselves that that things are different than they really are. And a lot of times with good actions, what we're doing is kind of saying, oh, I'm all selfless, and I'm going to do this for selfless reasons. And in fact, I'm you know, kind of doing it for selfish reasons. There's a classic thing that I remember you used to talk about with people working in the helping professions, the social services, and how difficult those are and how difficult they are to sustain without burning out. There's a high degree of burnout. And part of the reason that there's burnout is just because it's a hard job. But part of the reason is also that people are unwittingly doing actions with some subtle selfish motive, with the idea of changing the world in a way, with the idea of getting some kind of, I mean, I see myself doing this, getting some kind of confirmation for my positive actions. I'm going to be a monk and be the great wise person, and it's going to be great, and everybody's going to think I'm wonderful. Wake up. You're just going to be like yourself, and you're going to get the consequences for your actions. And the degree to which we're aware of that going on is the degree to which we can let it go, and then we find our own, our kind of real purpose in action. I'm not going to stop being a monk because I notice that I'm motivated. I have kind of weird motivations about it. I'm just going to work on letting go of those weird motivations and just do what's right in front of me, if you see what I'm saying. So if social service people hear me talking about this, I'm not advocating everybody kind of abandon their jobs or anything. I'm just saying we just have to really be grounded in the reality of our circumstances. And the more that we can become in tune with our own motivations and let go of selfish and distorted expectations, the more, in a way, healthily we can live. So there is a real possibility then that one of the actions that can happen is that we do a thing motivated by some positive impulse and find ourselves in suffering, and that suffering can be the result of our own selfish, unseen selfishness. And we just have to be aware of that. To my mind, I just have to be aware of that possibility. Zen practice is not for the faint of heart, in a way, because we're constantly kind of looking at ourselves, and I have to admit that all too often, if I see myself clearly in the mirror, I'm not really that great, you know. I'm not really that impressive. I'm not really that impressed with myself. Not that I, you know, over time I've just come to accept that's the case, and I can live with that, and I'm not unhappy being myself, but there is that quality of constantly kind of looking at myself and saying, "What are you getting up to now?" And I say that with a smile and as much kind of compassion as I can for myself. What are you getting up to now? What's your distortion? So that was one part of dependent origination. Any questions about that or comments on that? Or and I also then wanted to finally, in this section, touch on rebirth and just some general thoughts on rebirth. Now, the idea of rebirth in the West is met with mixed reviews. It's not one of your kind of popular ideas because, well, for a lot of different reasons, but for one thing, you can't really prove it. You can't really prove that it happens. It's not scientific. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, what is reborn and all those kind of questions. And we're definitely in an age of science, and the idea of the idea of believing in something kind of woo-woo like rebirth is just, you know, not very popular. But it is what the Buddha taught. The Buddha did teach that beings are reborn, and beings will continue to be reborn until they have resolved their spiritual problem on the deepest level, until they become Buddhas. And in one sense, that's really not necessarily a problem. I mean, it's just the way the world works. For those of us who have decided to pursue a Buddhist life, there is a lot of danger perceived in the continual rebirth in various realms, because we don't really know where we might end up or what kind of circumstances we find ourselves in. And what the Buddha offers us, what the Buddha Dharma offers us, is a way of making our way through this world of samsara, the world of birth and death, in a sane way, and in an open-eyed way, in a wise way. So the Buddha taught that beings are reborn again and again. And the Buddha taught that beings can be reborn into a lot of different kinds of circumstances. If you do evil actions, then you will quite possibly be reborn in quite difficult circumstances, hell realms and all of that. If you do good actions, then, like I say, you can be reborn into a heaven realm. It's really important to understand that all these things are impermanent, but we need to be realistic and open-eyed about it. If we do evil on the assumption that there isn't going to be a consequence, we're going to have a rude awakening. We will receive the consequences of that. Whether we believe in it or not, whether we say it can't be proved with science or not, there is consequences for our actions. And it is this idea of dependent origination again that gives us our handle on rebirth, and it conditions what we do. In other words, conditions not just the suffering or not suffering or joy or bliss that we've received in the next 10 or 15 minutes or in the next over the next 20 years or so, but also what we do in this particular life conditions our future rebirth. And of course, the critical thing is that the most important thing is that we are doing a spiritual practice, our religious practice, which that in itself has the most profound conditioning on our future life. Not in the sense that we'll be rich and have all the food that we want, but that whatever circumstances we encounter in the future, we will be able to accommodate them because we have the grounding in a spiritual practice. So what we're doing here in terms of practice has profound implications in terms of a whole, you know, kind of future existence, a whole number of future existences. Dogen says there are three periods of time in which the consequences of actions manifest. The present, the immediate future, and sometime in the present, the future of this particular life, and then sometime in a future existence. So actions, we have really no idea, most of us have really no idea what kind of actions people did in the past that we've inherited or that we're going to inherit. We have no idea what will arise for us in the future, even for this life or for future existences. We just don't have any idea what's going to happen on the level of karmic consequence. And, okay, that's fine. I mean, nobody has any idea really of what's going to happen anyway. So Fair enough, that's fine. What we're trying to do in terms of spiritual practice, again, is more clearly awaken to what's really going on in our lives so that we won't be fooled by the arising of future consequences. We will be able to recognize this is the consequence of some past action. Again, that idea of dependent origination, everything has a cause. So whatever arises in the future is due to a cause. Not everything is due to past karma. You know, this is just the kind of world where there are earthquakes and volcanoes, hurricanes and all that kind of stuff. and so there's a whole bunch of, again, everything's quite complicated, a whole bunch of different potential factors. But going into the future then with that idea of training is kind of leaves us one step ahead of the game, as it were. So dependent origination then ties right in with karmic consequence and the idea of rebirth. We don't necessarily have to believe in or disbelieve rebirth, whether it really happens or not. We don't really have to answer that question in one sense. The nice thing about practice is we don't have to decide. There's a way in which I find increasingly I take refuge in the quality of meditation where I don't have to activate my mind and make a decision about about something or about a person. I can just sit still and allow it to be what it is. And that, in a way, is this kind of great liberation. I don't have to, in a way, understand it even, although I might understand it and still not make a judgment about it, because making a judgment about it sort of implies that I then have to take some action with regard to it. But, you know, like people in my family are do kind of crazy things, and I can just not make a decision about it. And then I don't have to, you know, decide that they're crazy and get into a fight with them or not or whatever. They can just do crazy things and that's fine. And I can just be still and offer merit, loving kindness, and help if that, you know, is appropriate. The same is true with rebirth. It's this idea of the back burner. We can put any doctrinal thing that we encounter in the Dharma on the back burner. We don't have to make a decision about it. We can just set it on the back burner and let it percolate there. And if it becomes useful to us, great. If it doesn't become useful to us, fair enough. And I find that to be quite helpful with the idea of rebirth. If, you know, I've encountered a number of people, and even there are Buddhist teachers who won't even teach about rebirth. Say that it's pre-Buddhism and all that stuff. I don't know intellectually how they can do that, but that's the way it goes. For me, it's just easier to just set it on the back burner, in a sense, forget about it, and if it becomes useful, then great. If it doesn't, fair enough. Actually, the same is true with the idea of dependent origination or any of the other doctrines that we'll talk about. If this is helpful to you, for some reason, the first book I picked up about Buddhism as a young person, teenager, whatever, had this kind of huge exegesis of dependent origination in it. And for some reason, you know, it was really dry, but I thought, wow, this is kind of neat. So for some reason, it's kind of been right there for me right since the beginning. Not that I've made any kind of major study of it. Mostly it's kind of gone in one ear and out the other. But so it's been a useful idea to me. But if it's not useful to you, then feel free to just set it on the back burner and carry on. As I said in the beginning of this series of talks, we could just dispense with this series of talks and just sit, just go downstairs and sit, you know, and then have tea together and go home. And that would be completely fine in terms of practice. But for most of us, it's helpful to kind of talk about these ideas. So I think that's what I would like to, what I want to say tonight. Questions about this or questions about anything else that people want to talk about?
Okay. Have we already gone over the non-self? Or is that to come?
We let me just refer to the table of contents. We went by it, but I want to check and see whether it comes up again.
Well, the reason I asked is because I've been asked this question by other people,
mm-hmm.
and there's a kind of a subtle distinction between rebirth and reincarnation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And if you subscribe to non-self, then there's nothing to reincarnate.
Yes.
So I wonder if you could just go over that subtle distinction. Because a lot of people think, oh, you're Buddhist, you believe in reincarnation. And I say, no, I don't. And they look at me funny. I said, but I do believe in rebirth.
Uh-huh.
And they don't see that there's a difference.
Right. I think the thing that is important to emphasize about the principle of non-self is that is to articulate it in this way: there is no persistent, abiding, permanent self, with the emphasis on persistent, abiding, permanent self. It's not that there isn't a self, and the Buddha, in one sense, never actually, he would never say that there was a self or that there wasn't a self, but he would say there isn't a persistent, abiding, permanent self. And I think that is the way to go with, in terms of the distinction between reincarnation and rebirth. And in a way, the words don't quite do the job, but that's what we're left with, so that's, we have to make do with what we've got. Reincarnation implies some permanent entity that is reincarnated from lifetime to lifetime. Rebirth is just the continuous flow of changing circumstances. We do have a psychophysical being. I mean, I think you all recognize me when I'm, you know, kind of walking into the room, and you don't confuse me with George. And that's part of the functioning of Buddha nature, actually, to be able to make that distinction and see those differences. We don't have to discriminate about it. There's just a perception of difference. And that's fine. What happens on a practical level is that we think that there is some part of us that isn't going to change, or can't change, or we don't want to change and therefore can't change. But the reality of the principle of impermanence is that everything changes, everything is impermanent. So the self that you see, that you recognize as the psychophysical self that you recognize as Reverend Leon, while there's been a continuity from, you know, 50 years ago when I was born till now, I'm definitely not that person who was born 50 years ago, or the person that was running around 30 years ago, or even the guy who was building the forums out there this afternoon. I'm different. There's certain qualities that are the same, and we can see that. The critical thing that we understand is that we're different. And that is, in one sense, a frustrating notion, because it implies that we should be able to kind of change ourselves in an immediate way. But that doesn't happen either. So we're, in a way, we would like impermanence on our own terms, and we would like our lives on our own terms. But that's not the reality of life as we have it. We're, again, like that river. And a river is really a useful example to point out, a kind of visual example of what a life is like, and how it changes through space and time. We can't really, there are certain things that we, you know, can't do with rivers, although there's a lot that we can do depending on, you know, how much concrete and hydraulics you have. I'm thinking about the Columbia River back home, which is, you know, I think the fifth largest river in the world or something like that. It's an enormous river, and it's been there for a long time, and you see its effects. Nowadays they've put all these dams on it. So what it is basically a series of big lakes. And so superficially it's changed quite a bit in the last 100 years from what it was for its preceding 10,000 years. But in another way, it's still the Columbia River. So no self then is really just the doctrine of impermanence applied to our person. And the degree, it's really kind of radical impermanence. The degree to which we are impermanent is profound, and in certain sense, kind of frightening. Because when you kind of recognize, wow, I'm really kind of constantly changing. There's nobody in here to hold on to. It's a little bit, you know, disturbing. So does that address your question? Mm-hmm. I would just to reiterate, emphasize the impermanent, no persisting part of the no self. And in terms of rebirth and reincarnation implies a permanent self that is reborn. And there isn't such a permanent self. So we make the distinction by saying we recognize rebirth. Okay. No more questions. Thank you all for your patience.